On this edition of Celebrating Science, Anton Zeilinger on quantum teleportation. Brought to you by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an independent, nonprofit scientific research and education outreach organization, home to a growing cluster of international scientists who contemplate and calculate new ideas about the very essence of space, time, matter, and information. Perimeter Institute also offers a wide array of educational outreach activities for students, teachers, and members of the general public in order to share the joys of scientific research, discovery, and innovation. In this presentation, From Einstein to Quantum Information, Professor Anton Zeilinger describes how an understanding of photons eventually gave rise to the new field of quantum information. He describes his seminal experiments involving quantum teleportation and shares his views on the future of quantum cryptography and quantum computation. Professor Zeilinger is a highly honored experimental and theoretical physicist working on the foundations of quantum physics at the University of Vienna.
It's a privilege to be here in Waterloo, where you have this great Perimeter Institute. It's called an Institute of Theoretical Physics, and I'm an experimentalist. But sometimes theoreticians have to talk to experimentalists to find out whether what they do is really the way how nature behaves. Now, the title of my talk I chose From Einstein to Quantum Information, and I will tell you why in a moment. So let me just step back a little bit. And since I know that many of you are not physicists, explain a little bit how quantum physics came all about. Let's go back to the end of the 19th century, so something like 110 years ago. At that time, physicists thought that they basically understand everything. There were only very few open questions. And two of the open questions were, one was, where does the sun get its energy from? Because, you know, sun produces a lot of energy and sends it away all the time. And the second question was, in the layman's language, how to explain the color of glowing bodies? These were considered to be small questions, which will be settled someday. There was a famous comparison. These were kind of thought to be two small clouds on the otherwise blue sky in science. We understand everything, they're just two small clouds. Now it turned out that these two small clouds became, you know, very powerful thunderstorms, and they changed completely the pattern, the picture of physics. To understand where the sun takes its energy from, you need relativity theory, you need E equals mc squared, probably the most famous equation ever invented by any physicist. And to explain the color of glowing bodies, it seems to be a very trivial question, you need quantum physics, you need quantum mechanics. And the idea came, the basic breakthrough came in 1900 by a German physicist, Max Planck, whom you see here. What people did is, this is a kind of recreation of the original experiments done in Berlin at that time. Not the Berlin which then was called Kitchener, but the original Berlin. And the original Berlin is still called Berlin. So what people did is, they had a little oven here, which they could heat to high temperatures, with a small opening, and they studied the light coming out when you change the temperature. And it soon became apparent that this cannot be explained using the standard known laws of physics at that time. Sometimes people have a feeling for the future, and in that case, It was a couple of theoretical colleagues who found out that the light coming out of this oven here only depends on the temperature and nothing else. It does not depend on what you make your oven of, how the surface looks like, and so on. And physicists have a feeling. They know if something depends only on one parameter, as we call it, there must be a simple law. There must be something important behind it. But they didn't know what the law was, what the important thing behind it was, until Max Planck, the theoretician shown here, who worked on this problem, forced himself to an act of desperation. And the act of desperation was to assume that light is not a wave. Let me be a little bit more precise. At that time, the picture of light was that it is consisted of waves. It consists of waves, continuous waves. And Max Planck assumed that the energy exchanged between the waves of light inside the oven and the walls, that energy can only be exchanged in multiples of quanta, multiples of particles, multiples of smallest units of energy, which later were called a quanta. This idea of bringing something discontinuous into an otherwise continuous description was what Planck called his act of desperation, and he didn't like that. He didn't like that for at least 15 years of his life. He wasted basically 15 years to find another explanation, but didn't find it. Just to put the stage, quantum physics is not an exotic theory, but it's the basic of lots of modern high tech. Quantum physics brings a complete explanation of chemistry. The Austrian Nobel Prize winner Erwin Schrödinger said that his equation, Schrödinger equation, which is one of the fundamental equations in quantum physics, turned chemistry into a subfield of physics. I know that not all chemists like to hear that, but but I know that Schrödinger was correct. Another application of quantum physics is the understanding of semiconductors. Semiconductors, which are the heart of all these modern computer chips, and without quantum physics, we cannot understand how semiconductors work, and we would not have all these modern chips, for example. Another application of quantum physics is the understanding of the laser and things like that. I just want to tell you this so you don't have the feeling that quantum physics is an exotic thing. But there's one problem. And one problem with quantum physics is it's an extremely successful theory, but it has very strange features. And I will tell you a few of those in my talk. Richard Feynman, the famous American physicist, once said, "I think I can safely say that nobody today understands quantum mechanics. Understands in the sense of what does it tell us about the world? What kind of view of the world does it imply?" To stress again, quantum physics works perfectly well. I believe that there is no way that it can be wrong someday. Not all physicists share that opinion, I should say that. But I find it extremely unlikely that such a perfectly working theory will break down. By the way, Richard Feynman had all the rights to say this because he got his Nobel Prize for a very successful formulation of quantum mechanics. So he knew what he was talking about. Now, these I would say counterintuitive predictions of quantum mechanics motivated people to do experiments with individual quantum systems, and I will tell you a little bit about that, individual particles, which became possible basically since the 1970s because of important technological developments. most importantly because of the development of the laser. But these experiments were philosophically motivated. People wanted to find out, as my friend Danny Greenberger said, people wanted to find out whether the world is really that crazy. And they found out it is that crazy. But there's an interesting message now, and this is one of the messages of my talk, basically the central message. These experiments were in part motivated by Einstein's criticism of quantum mechanics. He was the first one who realized how strange some of the implications are. He criticized the theory, he wanted something else. It turns out that his position in important points is not tenable, so he is incorrect, but, and that's important now, he nevertheless laid the foundation for a new information technology that way. The point is that his criticism motivated people. It's really my feeling that without his criticism, we would not have gone so far in many of these experiments. Laid the foundation brought about the motivation of people to do these experiments. And doing these experiments, we developed tools which might now be useful in the new information technology. And that's actually an interesting development. Now, let us go to Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein, in 1909, very early, criticized quantum mechanics for the first time. He gave a talk at the annual meeting of the Society of German Scientists and Medical Doctors, a very interesting combination. That society still exists. And there he expressed his, what he calls, discomfort about the new role of randomness in quantum physics. The new role of randomness in which sense? People have lived with randomness all the time. I mean, I show you here a die. This is what we might call a random number generator. If you throw the die, you get, say, the number 6. Next time you throw the die, you get the number 2, and so on. And you get a sequence of random numbers if you throw the die many times. But the point is, at least in principle, if I throw a die, the behavior of the die is governed by what we call the laws of classical physics. So if I know all the details, I can in principle find out why in this specific throw a 6 shows up. If I know how I turn my hand and so on. And supposedly there are people who are able to do this in a tricky way, to get the right number, to get the number they want. So the important point is, for an event in classical physics, where classical physics is the branch where you don't need quantum mechanics, for an event in classical physics, a chain of cause and effect is at least conceivable. Even if you don't know what the cause of something happening is, everybody assumes automatically that there is a cause. There is a change of cause and effect. In quantum mechanics, we know that the assumption that there are causes for every event leads us into trouble. For quantum mechanics, we have learned, and this is what Einstein criticized, that events happen without sufficient reason. Einstein had all right to criticize quantum mechanics because this is what he got his Nobel Prize for. In 1905, the young Albert Einstein, this is a couple of years later, and you see with white tie, so he's celebrating something. This was actually not the Nobel Prize. It's a picture from him receiving the Max Planck Medal of the German Physical Societies. Is probably the highest prize you can get in Germany as a theoretical physicist. Albert Einstein in 1905, he was basically a nobody. He was a small clerk working at the Swiss Patent Office, and he wrote three papers which really changed our view of the world. One of the papers is relativity theory. Another paper is related to what's called Brownian motion, the motion of small particles due to the fact that they're hit by atoms. And the third paper, which was actually the first paper written in that year, was about the photoelectric effect. It was the explanation of a simple phenomenon. You have a metal plate, you shine light on it, and this light kicks out electrons, charged particles, from the surface. And this phenomenon had escaped explanation for quite a while. What Albert Einstein did is he took Max Planck's idea one step further, and he simply assumed that light consists of particles. Particles called photons today, and these particles kick out the electrons just like one billiard ball kicks another one. This was a very revolutionary idea. It runs against the prevailing idea at the time, namely that light is waves. And Albert Einstein himself, actually, in a letter to his friend Habicht in that year, calls this paper the only revolutionary one he wrote. So relativity theory was not that revolutionary as quantum mechanics. And you might understand that I like his position because I am a quantum mechanic in a sense, right? So anyway, this randomness, which Albert Einstein criticized, is most famous as the quantum jump, or also called quantum leap. Some people call it quantum leap. The quintessential quantum jump is this here. I apologize for the strange language here, but it's close enough to English that you, I guess, can understand what it means, okay? The quintessential quantum jump is shown here. This is a model of an atom. I apologize to the physicists that this is a naive model. It's the Bohr model. You have a nucleus, and you have your orbits of the electrons around. And what happens is, when you have an electron and you send in energy, for example, a light quantum, a quantum of light, the electron can be lifted to a higher orbit. And then at some later time, the electron can fall down to a lower orbit and emit again a particle of light, emit again a quantum. Now, this jump from a higher to a lower orbit is the quantum jump. And the essential point of a quantum jump is that it is a very small energy. It's basically the tiniest energy change you can imagine in this situation. And that's very important, it happens completely random. This is what Einstein criticized. It's random in the sense that there's nothing in the theory which allows you to predict at which time which quantum jump happens in which atom. This is objectively random. Now, it escapes me why a thing which is very small and completely random, the quantum jump, has, in English, is actually interesting, has acquired the name quantum leap, like something big, and that politicians or other people can be proud of that thing. I really don't understand. You know, it's nothing of any relevance. But we should actually search. I think somebody should search and find out why it happened. Why did people adopt this notion? But anyway, Einstein did not like this, and he once said that if an electron really should choose the moment when it jumps completely at free will and at random, he would rather work in a casino than be a physicist. Just to point out how important this randomness is conceptually, this is a picture there's a huge painting on the ceiling of a great hall in the old University of Vienna, and this is the allegory of the old faculty of philosophy, which included natural science. Like here, for example, you see a telescope. In the old time, physics, for example, was called natural philosophy. And the kind of motto of the of the faculty was, is this one down here, which says, causarum investigatio, to investigate the causes of things. That's the program of science. And the really surprising thing is that following this program, going deeper and deeper, finding causes, we suddenly, for the case of the individual quantum event, come to a stop. The individual quantum event happens without cause, period. It just happens. And to me, this is one of the conceptually deepest messages of science in the 20th century. And I know that many people have problems with this notion of randomness being objective, being there, and there's no way to get it out. This includes many physics colleagues who try to find a way around. But my personal feeling is that we have to live, and we have to accept randomness as something fundamental to the universe. Just to set the time scale again, this criticism of Einstein of randomness came in 1909. Well before 1925 and 1926, these were the years where Werner Heisenberg and Erwin Schrödinger, German and Austrian, formulated modern quantum physics, the full theory. So Einstein realized already, even before the full theory was there, that there's something strange happening. And this really, really tells you something about how deep a thinker Einstein was. By the way, Heisenberg did his work on Heligoland, the island of Heligoland. He suffered from hay fever, and his professor sent him for a couple of weeks to Heligoland, and there he had enough time to figure out the new quantum theory. So I guess someday we should send our bright young students or postdocs away for a couple of months and tell them come back with a new theory. Erwin Schrödinger is supposed to have found his theory when he was skiing on a ski hut up in the Alps, which is also a good way to do science, I suppose. And Schrödinger himself criticized the quantum jump. Also, he said, if this quantum jumps stay with us, I regret that I ever have bothered with physics. But he said this before he got the Nobel Prize for quantum mechanics. Anyway, to make a big step, I told you that one of the mottos of my talk is to tell you that the criticisms which Einstein put forward now are the basis of new technological ideas. And one of them is that you actually can use the randomness of individual quantum events to build random number generators. Random numbers are important in many applications, many calculations, many computers use random numbers, and they are usually created with some algorithms, with some mathematical schemes, where the result looks random and is pretty random, but it's really obtained by a deterministic procedure, so it is not absolutely random. The most random processes are quantum events, and here's a realization of such a random number generator using quantum physics. What you do is you take a light source, a weak light source in that case, and you take a half-silvered mirror, a half-reflecting mirror, a mirror which if you look at it, would reflects half of the light and half of the light goes through. So half of the light is reflected, half of it goes through. Now, if you have here individual photons coming, individual particles of light, what happens? What should they do? Because quanta cannot be divided. They are indivisible. So if you have an individual quantum coming here, it can end up either here or here. There's no other choice. And the point is that whether you find your particle here or here is completely random. It's random in the same way as the decay of the radioactive atom was random. The story is actually slightly more complicated, but I don't want to go into this. So if you send in many particles, you get random sequences of 0 and 1, which you can use then further on in some calculation. I would like to finish this part about randomness, which I mentioned. Some physicists still want to go around and find other explanations. But if Wolfgang Pauli, who received the Nobel Prize in 1945, is right, then, and I believe he is right, then such attempts probably will turn out to be not very successful. He said the statistical character of the psi function, which is the mathematical description of what we are talking about, the statistical character of the psi function will determine the character of natural law at least for a couple of centuries. That's a good statement, isn't it? And he cannot easily be proven wrong, because nobody of us will live in a couple of centuries. But I really believe he's wrong, and my feeling is the time span is probably somewhat longer than that. The next point I would like to raise here, in the point of view of Einstein's criticism leading to possible applications, came up in a paper for the first time in 1935, a paper which Einstein wrote together with Podolsky and Rosen at the Institute of Advanced Study in Princeton. You know, Einstein had been professor in Berlin, but he was forced to emigrate because of the Nazis coming to power, and he moved to the Institute of Advanced Studies in Princeton. And there he collaborated with these two young people at that time to write this paper. But it is known now that Einstein had worried about these questions already for a couple of years. And not only he, Schrödinger also. So what Einstein, this is actually an interesting paper because it has a strange title for a physics paper. Can quantum mechanical description of physical reality be considered complete? That's a philosophical question in a sense. So it's basically, the whole paper is basically a philosophical question. But it appeared in Physical Review, probably because Einstein was the first author. Now, but one should investigate the situation. But what Einstein does in that paper is he considers a situation where you have two particles which interact with each other at some time. So, for example, they were scattered like two billiard balls, scattered from each other at some time. And at a later time, when the two particles are well separated, just indicated like this here, well separated over a large distance, then you can observe a very interesting phenomenon. When you measure one of the particles, the result of the measurement will be random, but that measurement will change the state of the other one instantly, no matter how far it is away. That's a prediction of quantum mechanics. And Albert Einstein realized, basically, if this measurement here determines the state over there, then you could think of doing different measurements there. You could measure, for example, he talked about momentum or position for measuring here. You could consider different measurements here, different observations which you choose, you decide what to measure as an experimentalist, and that implies different states over there. And he says, in each case you can make a prediction with certainty. And he basically says that the real nature, the real factual situation over there must be independent of what you do here. And since quantum mechanics doesn't give you that, quantum mechanics must be incomplete. There must be a more complete formulation. Erwin Schrödinger, in the same year, 1935, also wrote a very important paper analyzing the situation. And I was always surprised that Schrödinger was able to answer so briefly, within basically 1 month. And it turns out now from documents which have not been available for a long time, But Schrödinger had worried about these questions already for a couple of years. He just didn't publish it. He didn't need it anymore because he had already the Nobel Prize, so he didn't have to compete. Schrödinger invented the name entanglement for this situation, indicating it, actually in German for those of you who speak German, we call it Verschränkung, which is a better name. But Schrödinger also. The reason is entanglement sounds a little bit messy. You know, entanglement is a little bit like spaghetti can be entangled. But Verschränkung is a very well-defined concept. It's Verschränkung is like this, for example. The situation simply is that you have two particles which, for example, if these were quantum dice, a pair of quantum dice, then they come from a common source. And when you throw one of the two dice, it shows you, for example, a six. And you know definitely that your friend throwing the other die at a distant galaxy will also get a six. For the next pair of dice, you get a two. Your friend will also get a two. This is correlations which Einstein worried about. Now one could think. That there is a natural explanation for this kind of correlation. One could simply think that these are loaded dice. Or some complicated mechanism in there. The dice are born in a way that there's a complicated mechanism in there which makes sure that when you throw this die, it produces a six, and they have the same mechanism, so the other one will also produce a six. This idea has actually been put forward for quantum particles, and it's called a hidden variable theory, a local hidden variable theory. So the two systems are born with identical features. The question is whether such theories are possible, and they would provide a completion of quantum mechanics. And the way I read the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paper was that Einstein really believed in such a theory. Here's the end of the paper. While we have thus shown that the wave function does not provide a complete description of the physical reality, we left open the question of whether or not such a description exists. We believe, however, that such a theory is possible. Now, the point is that such a theory is ruled out with the premises of Einstein, that you have a reality existing independent of us, and that things don't influence each other over large distances instantly, the locality assumption. This is ruled out by Bell's theorem. The question whether such a more complete theory exists was for a long time considered to be just academic. Wolfgang Pauli, whom I quoted already, once said that it makes as little sense to worry about the existence of such a theory as the old question, how many angels can sit on the tip of a needle? You know, this question, how many angels can sit on the tip of a needle, was supposedly discussed by the scholastic philosophers, but nobody knows whether they really discussed such crazy things. But anyway, yeah, it's a serious question. It probably was invented in the 19th century as an argument against scholastic philosophers. But that's a different story. What John Bell considered was a simple experiment where the experiment itself, the version of the experiment itself, was invented by David Bohm in 1952. And that was, suppose you have a simple case, you have a source which produces, in this case, particles which are entangled in a specific property, namely in spin. I show this for two particles, for two photons. So the source produces pairs of entangled photons, and we send each of the two photons into a polarizer. The polarizer acts the following way, that if the photon is horizontally polarized, it goes out in this channel. If the photon is vertically polarized, it goes out in this channel. And likewise over here. Now, you can create entangled pair sources where the entanglement is such that the photons have the same polarization. So whenever I get one here, I get the brother here. Whenever I get one here, I get the brother here. And what Bell considered is to explain this kind of perfect correlations with the assumption I just mentioned, with the assumption that what happens at the measurement is determined already at the source. The particles carry properties with them which determine what they should do. So in a simple way, you know, the particle has a list with it, and then the list it says, if the polarizer is oriented that way, I have to go to this detector. If the polarizer is oriented another way, I have to go to that detector, and so on. This is called local hidden variables. And John Bell found out that this idea is in conflict with quantum mechanics. The predictions of such a model, a model which allows you to explain these correlations on the basis of properties of the particles, local properties of the particles, is in conflict with the predictions of quantum mechanics. And the proof which Bell gives is extremely simple. For the proof, you don't need to know any quantum physics. It's actually surprising. The proof is so simple that I always suggested that had Aristotle known that this is not a trivial question, he could have given the derivation. It's extremely only a few lines. So now, in 1965, we suddenly have a conflict between the idea of a hidden variable theory, which explains these perfect correlations of the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paper and quantum mechanics, which was completely unexpected. And people started to do experiments, and they found out that the world really is so strange. To show you how such sources look like, it's very simple. You have a kind of a crystal. You send in an ultraviolet light pump, and if it's the right sort of crystal, then the photons are created in pairs. That pairs of photons created, which, when they come out along specific directions, are entangled in polarization with each other. That's a picture taken of the photons coming out here. It's beautiful rings. The point is that these are false colors. The whole thing is just in red and ultra and infrared, but that's not so important. Now let's make again the jump to today, from Einstein's criticism to today's experiments. I mentioned that entanglement has been demonstrated in many experiments. These experiments started in the 70s. If this is actually a nice coincidence in history, that that Bell's paper came out in the mid 60s, and then at about that time the laser was invented, so experiments became possible. Here's an experiment which we did recently in 2003, where we demonstrate this entanglement outdoors, not in the laboratory. We have a source here sitting in some container. I'll show you a picture in a minute. And we send the two photons to two different stations separated by a couple of hundred meters. The point here is to demonstrate that entanglement can be used for communication someday, even in free space. This was, by the way, the biggest fun experiment which I ever participated in. We had to do the experiment at night, because you send individual photons, you send individual particles of light, so you don't want the sun sending additional photons. And it's actually one of the most advanced ways to discover a sunrise. Because suddenly, for the physicist among you, suddenly the violation of Bell's inequality disappears. This is because of the additional photons of the sun. As you can imagine, this was in March 2003. We were working at the River Danube in Vienna. It was cold, it was freezing, windy, but we had great fun. And the whole experiment was done, was finished in 4 nights. So here's again a picture of the setup, the source, and all the apparatus is inside this container here. The individual photons are come out of the container along glass fibers, and they are fed into small home-built telescopes with which we can send the photons to the different measurement stations. Here, for example, is a measurement station on the other side of the river. The source is here, and we send the individual photons over across the river. By the way, in the close by, there's a Buddhist pagoda, but I'm pretty convinced that this has nothing to do with the result of the experiment. The experiment showed that even in this free space thing, you get the entanglement, what's called a spooky action by Albert Einstein. By the way, the apparatus to measure the photons is extremely simple. You see not many components, which is important for future technological applications. An experiment which is going on right now, and we published the first results just recently, is an experiment where we go to larger distances. We have the source up here on an old astronomical observatory on hills above Vienna. So the source sits up here on the roof, and we send these two individual entangled photons, one to the south to a skyscraper and one to the east to another skyscraper. Why do we do this? The distances are 8 kilometers and 7 kilometers. Why do we do this? In the end, we want to go up to satellites. We want to establish satellite communication using these individual photons. And it is known that the atmosphere gets thinner and thinner. To go all the way from a ground station up to a satellite is equivalent to going about 5 kilometers horizontally, because the atmosphere gets thinner so fast. That already shows you how thin and fragile the atmosphere is. Only 5 kilometers horizontally is the same as going all the way up. So having these distances, 7 and 8 kilometers, and having them in a city, which is atmosphere with all kinds of turbulences and dirt and dust and everything, and having been able to prove that entanglement works here, we know that at least from the point of view of the quality of the transmission of the information, we will be able to go up to satellites. Here's a picture, actually. You saw this picture already. Some of you maybe. It was my first transparency with the title. In the background, it was not just black. It was this picture here. That's a picture taken from one of the skyscrapers, looking over to where the source is. Source is over there, across Vienna. For those specialists of you might recognize that this is Vienna. So the idea in the end is to put a source up on a satellite and to communicate with two different ground stations. That is to establish this is a program of the European Space Agency, and I understand that similar programs like that might go on in the United States, so there nobody wants to talk about this with us. I don't know why. Okay. So why bother? Why do this? One application, and that is an application which is already basically ready. Some developmental work has to be done, but the application is basically ready, is quantum cryptography. Quantum cryptography is about transmission of secret messages in a way that they are encoded such that no eavesdropper, no spy, no unauthorized person has any chance to find out what the information is. And the interesting point is that quantum cryptography provides the only way for information to be secure, where the security is guaranteed by laws of quantum physics. There are various schemes of quantum cryptography. I just want to talk about the one which uses Einstein's entanglement. The entanglement-based quantum cryptography was proposed theoretically in 1990 by Arthur Eckert. What you see here is a scheme, a realization of entanglement-based quantum cryptography, which we did. We actually did it in 1998, but it took us 2 years to publish it because we are slow in publishing. We rather do the experiment. So the basic idea is the following. You create pairs of entangled photons, one after the other, and you send them to two measurement stations, to Ellis and Bob. Ellis and Bob are the two guys who want to exchange secret information. Because of this entanglement, that if you measure the polarization on the two sides, and if these polarizers are oriented the same way, you will get the same result for each measurement on both sides. So for example, for one pair, you will get the one here. For the other photon, you get the one here also. For the next pair, you might get 0, 0. For the next one, say again 0, 0, and so on. The point is, if you send many pairs, in the end, Ellis ends up with a large sequence of random numbers. And Bob also ends up with a large sequence of random numbers, but these sequences are identical because of the entanglement. So they end up with large sequences of identical random numbers. And it is known from mathematical theorems that if you have such long sequences of random numbers, you can use them to encode messages. These sequences are the key to encode a secret message. And if the sequence is completely random and is used only once, then there's no way to tap the information, no way to get out the information. Here's a picture of the quantum cryptography experiment, which we did back at that time. This is a picture of the original, which we want to transmit from Ellis to Bob. And these are the keys, the random keys. This is an optical representation of the sequences of random numbers. Each point here corresponds to a number of these random bits. And the important point being that each of those is completely random, but they are identical. They are the same patterns. So what's really beautiful in this scheme is that the key, which is used by Ellis and Bob, does not have to be transported between them. It comes into existence at both sides at the same time. And you can imagine that transporting a key is a security problem. You don't have the security problem. Quantum mechanics generates the same key for you at both places. Now, what you do in experiment is you mix point by point, you mix the original information with the key. For the mathematicians among you, this is a bitwise XOR operation, and out comes the encoded picture. This is the encoded message, which is not quite the same as this one if one looks closely, because hidden behind it is the original. Now, since this is completely random, there's no way to tap the information. The only person who can find out is Bob, who can decode the message. I should actually, it's interesting, you might ask, why did we choose this picture to demonstrate quantum cryptography? And the story is actually quite simple. My colleagues, who did the work in the lab, they came to me with a picture of this, what's it called? Stealth bomber. You know, this bomber which is supposedly invisible radar. It's certainly invisible to Iraqi radar. I don't know whether it's invisible to all kinds of radar. But anyway, so they came with this picture, and I told them, wait a minute. We have to choose something which is Austrian and peaceful. And this picture is actually famous. It's called Venus of Willendorf. It was found in the Wachau area, about 80 kilometers from Vienna. It's one of the oldest statues of a human person. So the status of quantum cryptography is such that it is basically close to being ready for commercial applications. We are part of a large European network where the goal is to develop turnkey quantum cryptography systems which operate such that you just plug them into existing cryptography systems at banks, for example, and so on. So all the software, all the hardware, everything there, you just have to connect the things. There are standalone cryptography systems you can buy already, but you really want something which you just plug in. To demonstrate how far we are, we used our system on 21st April 2004 to demonstrate the first real bank transfer using quantum cryptography. For you here in Canada, this doesn't mean much, but it is actually the bank transfer slip which we use in Austria to transfer money. And usually you sign here. This is the field where you sign. And here is what the computer does, the various steps in generating the key and so on. The interesting point is what happened was that the bank where we did this transferred actually 3,000 euros. It was real money, not just, the real money they transferred into our account. Our account. So they donated 3,000 euros for our research. The interesting part of this is down here. Here we show the key. This is the complete key here, used in that case to encode all the information you see here. This key was created live. There was a live link, a live quantum cryptographic link with entangled photons at that moment. And you see the key here is in hexadecimal representation, 7F07 and so on and so on. Okay. So as I said, the status is that we are getting to have commercially viable systems within a very few years, probably about 3 to 5 years. And then it's basically a question who decides to really use them. I once talked to a banker, it's not so long ago, a banker in Austria, and I told him about this, and he says, yes, I understand, this is really secure, absolutely, there's no question. And then I asked him, why don't you use it? He said, no, I don't want to be the first. But as soon as the competition uses it, I also have to use it because I have to show my customers that my systems are as secure as the ones of the competition. So we have to get the bank who uses it really routinely all the time. Now, so this quantum cryptography is one of the applications of these schemes I mentioned before to distribute entanglement over larger distances. Kind of from conceptually, the most exciting application is a quantum teleportation, a scheme which was proposed by these six colleagues, Bennett, Brassard, Crepeau, Joseph, Perez, and Wouters. And I know that at least one of the authors, Brassard, is in the audience. Maybe some other authors are also hiding, you never know. It could be. The idea is actually a very interesting idea. And I just want to go a little bit through the logic. Again, I apologize for the strange language, but that's not so bad, I think. What we have is we have two players again, Alice and Bob. And Alice has a photon, say, but it could be something else. A photon in some state. some state, meaning in that case, most experiments with some polarization, for example. And Alice wants Bob to have a photon in exactly that state. But let's assume that at the moment they do the experiment, they have no good connection. So they cannot send directly the particle from Alice to Bob. Now, if you talk about teleportation, people always think of these ideas of teleporting people or teleporting humans or whatever in science fiction movies. The concept there is that you have an object, any object, and I mean the idea is not so bad from a conceptual point of view, that you have a way to scan all the information, to scan all the information of the original, and send the information over, and reconstitute the original using all this information. Now the problem is that quantum mechanics tells us that this is impossible. It's a consequence of what's called Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. If you only have one quantum system, or if you only have one system, then it's completely impossible by measurement to determine the full state of the system. This is because of the fact that in quantum mechanics, measurement disturbs the state in an uncontrollable way. And it turns out that the people who did this Star Trek movie actually knew of that problem. And for those of you who are fans of the story, you know what they did. They invented what's called the Heisenberg compensator. And supposedly at one press conference, one of these guys who did this movie was asked, "How does the Heisenberg compensator work?" And his answer is really classic. The answer was, "Very well, thank you." So let's get back to the conceptual problem. We have learned from quantum mechanics, and that is now really an interesting intellectual question. It is impossible to extract all information, to determine all information of a system carries. It's completely impossible, and therefore you cannot do this scheme. Now, what the idea of these guys was is really extremely elegant. What they realized is that in order to transfer the information carried by one system over to another one, you don't need to determine the information. You don't need to know it. That's really a fantastic idea. And I should mention, by the way, it's information which is important. I mean, what defines this bottle is the way how the atoms are arranged. Which atoms you use is completely unimportant. Now, the point is that there is a way to directly transfer the information carried by the original by using entanglement. The verschränkt, here's the entangled. This means entangled. So what Alice and Bob do is they share an entangled pair. Let's now talk about specifically teleportation of photons. And in particular, let's assume we want to teleport the polarization state here, the polarization of the photon. So what Alice and Bob do, they share a pair of photons entangled in polarization. Let me just repeat what entanglement means. In a specific case, and we talk only about that one, it means that the two photons are identically polarized, but that they don't have a polarization before you measure them. Okay? And what Alice now does is she takes her original and entangles it with one of the two photons from that pair. Entanglement means a unique relationship between these two. The original, the way you produce the photons also means a unique relationship between these two. And therefore, by a simple logical chain, you know how this photo now relates to the original. And it turns out that there are four different results for this entangling procedure, which is called a Bell state measurement in honor of John Bell, the physicist who I mentioned before. In one of the four cases, the photon over there is instantly gets the state of the original. In the other three cases, you have to rotate it in a specific way. So in one of the four cases, it instantly gets the state of the original. That's actually the most interesting one. And we might now ask, now is this just, the point is we just send the information. We don't send stuff, we don't send matter whatsoever. We just send the information. So is it just copying? Is it just faxing? The answer is no. The answer is no, because, and that's important, this particle becomes entangled with this one. To become entangled means that the particle loses its own private properties. So the information carried by the particle disappears, and it shows up as information carried by the other one. The way you do the experiment is you send in many different kind of photons in different polarizations, and you prove every time that the photon coming out here is just the one, has just the properties which you prepare over there. Now the status of this kind of experiments is basically similar to what I mentioned before in entanglement research and in quantum cryptography. My student Rupert Ursin just half a year finished a paper where we did long distance teleportation. We create a pair of photons. One of the two photons is sent outdoors in a quantum channel in an optical fiber on the other side of the river Danube. This is again at the river Danube, to the other side of the river Danube through a large sewer. And this is the reason why we call it the third man experiment. Some of you, and I hear some of you know the movie The Third Man, which is one of the 10 best movies ever made in the history of cinematography, and it plays actually in the sewers of Vienna. So this is where we are again here. In the experiment, we create the photon to be teleported. So this is the entangled pair. We create the photon to be teleported. We do a Bell state measurement. We can identify now two of the four possibilities. We send the result of information over to the other side, and we can apply the rotation necessary to get out the original, to get out the original state. This experiment actually has a beautiful feature in the sense that the entangled photon propagates here in a glass fiber, and the classical signal, the signal of what the measurement result was, propagates as a radio wave. It turns out that the speed of light in a glass fiber is only about two-thirds the speed of light of a radio wave in vacuum. Both very fast. I mean, the vacuum is 300,000 kilometers per second, and this propagates with only 200,000 kilometers per second. But the difference is enough to achieve an interesting feat, namely, if you measure really, really very fast, and we have very fast electronics, this signal can arrive over at the other station before the photon arrives, and the apparatus can be set right to give the correct result. As I mentioned, we are dreaming of worldwide quantum communication, maybe teleport the output of a quantum computer over to another quantum computer somewhere else in the world. And I'm one of the few people, I know many people in the community are not as optimistic as I am, but I'm really convinced that someday we will have information technology where basically everything is quantum. This is one of these visions where you have quantum computers connected through such teleportation links. It's also called entanglement swapping. There are groups, including us, working on establishing the possibility of these links. I already mentioned the word quantum computer, and this is basically what I want to come to an end now. A quantum computer is essentially you have the information represented in a quantum way. You have information in superposition of different probabilities, different possibilities. You utilize, for example, entanglement, quantum entangled states inside a quantum computer. We call this a quantum chip. Maybe we should copyright the name. I'm sure it will happen someday. A quantum chip. There are various ideas how to build such a quantum computer. One of the ideas is pursued by Ray Laflamme here in Waterloo, where this kind of physical implementation is done with nuclear magnetic resonance ideas. Another possibility is to use chains of ions. These are actually photographs of individual atoms, individual ions, trapped in suitable magnetic and electric fields, where this is basically the register of such a quantum computer. There are various things a quantum computer can do much faster than a regular one, but that, in my eyes, is not the issue. The issue is that computer chips get smaller and smaller and smaller all the time, and we will naturally arrive at quantum computation some days, even if we don't want it, when the chips are so small that an individual bit of information is carried by one electron only. I should like to come to an end. I dared to make some prediction about the future, and the future is always hard to predict, as everyone knows. As some German author once said, it's very hard to make predictions, particularly if they concern the future. Now, this is a quote from Popular Mechanics magazine in March 1949, where they say, "Where a calculator on the ENIAC," ENIAC was one of the first computers ever built, "is equipped with 18,000 vacuum tubes and weighs 30 tons. Computers in the future may have only 1,000 tubes and weigh only 1.5 tons. It couldn't be more wrong than this prediction, because chips these days don't contain tubes anymore, and they don't contain 1,000 tubes, but millions of active elements, and they don't weigh 1.5 tons, but only grams or maybe even milligrams. So as I mentioned, I'm really convinced that someday we will have quantum computers, we will have machinery where information is exchanged with individual quanta, and basically utilizing the concepts which Einstein criticized when he criticized quantum mechanics. Now, I told you in the beginning, I gave you this quote of Feynman, "Nobody today understands quantum mechanics." So let me come back to that for a moment. The question is, what does quantum mechanics tell us about the world? And in my opinion, the message is, or the problem is, I told you that, for example, the state over there depends on what you do over here and things like that. The basic problem in my eyes is that before quantum mechanics, we have the picture that there is a reality out there, and we basically move through it like through a theater. The reality is essentially independent of us. In my opinion, that message is not tenable. The reality depends in a very significant way on our actions, on the questions which we ask. The kind of question we ask actually can determine what becomes reality. So the question is, what is more fundamental? Where can we go back? And it turns out, and that is my conviction, that the basic message of quantum physics is that information is more fundamental than reality. There is an article written by Hans Christian von Bayer in this issue of New Scientist about our work in the interpretive in the interpretation of quantum mechanics. The title of this article is "In the beginning was the bit," instead of "In the beginning was the word." So basically, the basic idea is that what can be said about the world puts very severe restrictions about what can be reality. And that is kind of turning the things around. It's not reality is the primary concept and information is derived, but information determines what reality can be. And it turns out that some basic features of quantum physics, like randomness or entanglement, can easily be explained on the basis of that. If you're interested more, this article is available on our website. I could not have done the work I mentioned here without the collaboration of all these, of many, many young people. This is a picture of my group. It's already two years ago. We should do a new picture now because people change all the time. But actually, this is one of the benefits. That's exactly the satellite which we will put up. But it's one of the benefits in my business, so to say, that I can work with young people all the time and they have fresh ideas and they challenge you and so on and so on. I would like to conclude coming back again to Einstein and to his motivation. And as I said, even as Einstein was not right, he should be credited for pointing the finger at an important issue. Albert Einstein once said, "I want to know how God created this world. I'm not interested in this or that phenomenon. I want to know his thoughts. All the rest are just details." Only Einstein could have said that. Thank you very much.
Fiber optic systems over long distances require amplification. Does the quanta maintain its information through that amplification system?
Well, that is a very good question. The answer is no. The answer is, the problem is that and basically there are two ways to look at this. Basically, amplification means measurement. And that means a disturbance of the quantum state. Another way to look at it is that there are basically basic theorems which say that quantum states cannot be perfectly cloned. This can be viewed as something like in these procedures, information has to be conserved. So the information carried by one particle then has to be, if you have an amplifier, carried by two particles, so they share it, so they cannot be in perfect states. So that is a problem of quantum communication over large distances. Both with glass fibers and in free space, the typical distance is of the order of 20 to 30 kilometers. There might be special situations where you can go farther. And that is the reason why we want to go to satellites. Because if you go to satellites, you only have to go through a few kilometers of atmosphere, and then you are in vacuum, and you can cover very large distances.
It seems to me there's a very simple form of a quantum cryptographic machine that uses the half-silvered mirror experiment. And you have two possible incident directions for the first half mirror. You can choose the direction of the incident, that the incident photon enters the half-silvered mirror experiment. So you have two different directions at 90 degrees. You could almost use that as a type of an old telegraphic machine. If you choose, if you can alternate the directions, and and make a signal of zeros and ones, it can't be intercepted, but it'll come out the other end, the second half silver mirror, it'll come out in the same direction that it went in. So that's really a cryptographic machine, is it not? Would that work?
Well, actually schemes like that can be made. It's a slightly more complicated, but the basic idea is a correct one. You can take half silvered mirrors, and it's not the same. That is slightly different. No, it's not the same. I mean, the point is what you want is you want to send your particle in here or here, and you want to get it out here or here. And that could be done basically with a what's called an interferometer. You could have a half silvered mirror, then the photon in here, and then you have two paths connecting the two sides. And if you do it right, then the photon comes out the right way on the other side. That is absolutely correct. Yes.
Hi, I'd just like to know, how do you entangle the photons in the first place? And then do they stay entangled forever, or can you unentangle them somehow?
That's a very good question again. The way we entangle them in the first place is that we create the photons inside the crystal in such a way that usually you can control whether they are both this way or they are both this way, okay? Along specific directions, you can create them either this way or this way. And if you do it right, the two possibilities cannot be distinguished, and that means entanglement. Can entanglement get lost? Yes, entanglement can get lost over propagation over large distances because of scattering at atmosphere and all this kind of thing. But if you propagate through vacuum, then there should be no limit in distance.
In your entanglement experiment, when you were sending the photon in free space across the Danube, how did you know that the photon received was the actual photon sent?
That is also a very good question. There are two ways. In one sort of experiment, we create the photons with very short light pulses. Light pulses which are only about 100 femtoseconds long, so very, very short. So we know exactly when the photon is supposed to arrive, and we can identify it that way. In other experiments, we don't do that. We pump the crystal with a continuous laser, so we have no control about at which time the photon arrives. So what we do is we register all particles on both sides, and we have very precise clocks. And then we simply compare the two registrations. We find out at which times both detectors registered a clock coincidentally. And then we know these two belong to each other. So it's always over the timestamp to find out that they belong to each other.
This edition of Celebrating Science has been made possible by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics through the support of private and public funding partners, including the Government of Canada and the Government of Ontario. To learn more about the Institute and to enjoy other programs, visit us online at perimeterinstitute.ca.